This is tape number 5, side number 1 of The Missing Dimension in 6.
In the past 20 or 30 years, teenagers have come to recognize that there are advantages in organization and numbers. Actually, it started back in the 20s with the Sheiks, the Flappers, and the Charlestonites. Then came jitterbugs, bobby soxers, and then actual sex clubs and gangs. In Britain, there were the Teddy Boys, succeeded by the Mods, or Moderns, and the Rockers, rock and rollers. In many communities, police and citizens alike have been shocked at the exposure of existing non-virgin clubs. Many disguised themselves as teenagers' social clubs. They played sexual games. In some clubs, partners were drawn by lot. Club rules required illicit relations not less frequency than once a week. Girl members were initiated by sacrificing their virginity in a ceremony witnessed by all members. There have been teenage drinking and sex parties, also marijuana or pot parties where drugs and free sex are passed around. There have been hippie rock festivals and love-ins where nudity and sex are commonplace. Teenage morality and respect for decency have plunged to an all-time low. Many youths express the attitude that there is nothing wrong with illicit or promiscuous sex. And why? Take one typical example. A 19-year-old boy had been in a certain town only 6 months. He named to police 11 girls with whom he had engaged in illicit sex, many from the best families. You can make almost any girl in town on your first date, he said. And this particular scandal, which got into the newspapers, revealed facts were significant. Of all involved, not one had received any formal sex education, boys or girls. Every boy had engaged in premarital sex before age 15. Not one was close to either father or mother. The police chief exclaimed that it was too bad he was unable to take a horsewhip to the neglectful parents. One of the mothers whitewashed herself of blame, saying, "You can't blame me for Janie's predicament. Why, you can rest assured she never learned a thing about sex in my house. The word was never even so much as mentioned." Teen sex and violence worldwide. The fast-growing surge of teenage immorality, drugs, and violence is worldwide. Accompanying sexual promiscuity, news dispatches pile up an avalanche of reports of wreckage, destruction of property, especially schools, pillaging, arson, violence, and often murder. There are facts and statistics on teenage immorality and juvenile delinquency to fill this entire book many times over. But why? What is the cause? The world doesn't want to hear the true answer. The world refuses to face the tragic truth. The true answer is this. Something has been taken away from this earth that sorely needs to be restored. That something is knowledge of, respect for, and obedience to the government and the law of God. But will any like that answer? Most want to go on rebelling against their maker, trying to find some other solution to their problems. There is no other. Once there was peace, happiness, orderliness, joy on this earth. You don't have to believe it, but it's true. Angels inhabited the earth. The Almighty God had placed a top-ranking archangel, Lucifer, to administer the government of God on the earth. Lucifer was a brilliant cherub. He sealed the sum total of wisdom and beauty. It went to his head. He became vain. Vanity gripped him. His mind swelled with resentment because he ruled only this earth, a mere speck in the universe, while God ruled all the universe. A third of the angels followed him in warlike aggression to knock God off his throne and take over the universe rule, but they were driven back to the earth. Physical chaos struck the earth as a result of this stupendous mutiny. In 6 days, God restored the earth and created mankind upon it. Psalm 104, verse 30. God made man mortal, of material substance, but he gave man mind power. When man chose to disobey God, to do evil, his mind became hostile toward God. He imbibed Satan's attitude of self and rebellion. This became human nature. Human nature includes the attitude that had become Satan's. Lucifer's name now changed to Satan. Human nature is a pull, like the power of gravity, in the direction of vanity, greed, self-love, and spirit of competition, hostility, indifference, resentment, or hatred toward others. That is man's natural attitude and tendency. It is a constant pull on man in that direction. It is the way that comes naturally. because a subtile Satan, still on Earth's throne, begins injecting that attitude during the first year of infant life. Human nature minus purpose. Let's understand the real basic reason for these present problems. Basically, it is simply human nature. Yet God endowed man with mind power, capable of recognizing the error of this way, if willing. Adam could have obeyed God, resisted Satan, and qualified to replace Satan as earth ruler, administering the government of God. But Adam disobeyed God, succumbed to Satan. His children have done so ever since. Jesus Christ obeyed God, kept God's commandments, resisted Satan, never allowed what we call human nature to enter him. He conquered the devil and qualified to administer the world-ruling government of God. Then he ascended to heaven to officially receive this world rule. The heavens have received him until, notice it, Acts 3, verses 19 through 21, only until the times of restitution of all things, that is, the restoring of what had been taken away, the government of God. That time is almost upon us now. This very outburst of universal violence is one of the signs. As it was in the days of Noah, said Jesus, so shall it be just before the days of Christ's return to restore the kingdom of God and bring us peace. Just before the flood, there was illicit sex and violence. It was not thus 60 years ago. It is a time of illicit sex and violence today. Can't we see the handwriting on the wall? Why all this violence, this immorality? Here is the cause. Human nature, which is vanity, without any purpose, an absence of parental training and discipline. There is no sense of purpose today. We are told we must adjust to living in a world of problems with no solutions. Nuclear war, the erasure of human life from the earth, appears to be just around the corner, liable to strike us any second. Young people today are given nothing to live for, no hope, no future. They are more prosperous than ever before. They are bored. They are rebellious. The spirit of revolt is in the air. They resent all authority. Yet vanity within them seeks to exalt itself. Why did Lee Oswald shoot and kill President Kennedy? Frustrated vanity. He sought status. He sought it the wrong way. America turned him down. Russia turned him back. He was a little man, incapable of greatness, yet he desperately craved to do something that would make him stand out in history, make the world take notice of him. Even the Warren Commission could find no other motive. Why do aimless, purposeless, bored, yet prosperous teenagers resort to violence? Says an article in Reader's Digest, boys explode into violence to prove they are grown up. Some, unable to succeed in school, seek status through hooliganism. There it is, to seek status. Plain vanity, but minus any constructive or healthy purpose. Their parents have failed. One father said of his boy in police trouble, "It isn't my fault. Why, I've always given him everything he wanted. I can't understand why he did this terrible thing." Yes, this father gave him money, but he failed to give him right teaching, training, a purpose in life, proper discipline, instilling in this boy a sense of responsibility and respect for authority. And he probably denied him love and true father-son companionship. Also, he failed to teach him the truth about sex. Teenagers need factual instruction. It is not exactly a paradox that millions of teenagers have had considerable sex experience and yet possess little sexual knowledge. It is largely because of ignorance or lack of right instruction in the right manner at the right time that adolescents seek to satisfy curiosity by experience. And of course, they are sheep, and when it becomes a trend, when it's being done, human nature wants to belong, so they go with the crowd and parents know nothing of it. Even when growing children and adolescents do receive some formal sex education, it is always presented from the physical, the material, and therefore the sensual approach. If teenagers had been properly taught what they needed to know about sex from the very first and second years of their lives by informed and loving parents, the frightful tragedies of teenage and premarital sex would have been reduced to the barest minimum. Today, if you tell a teenager that necking is wrong, that it ought never to be indulged in, that it is a definite sin, that it robs their future marriage of much of its possible joys, delights, and blissful happiness, the young man or woman will probably look at you rather pityingly, wondering how you could be so naive. he would probably reverse the truth and exclaim, "Oh, you poor ignorant jerk, why, where have you been that you don't know the facts of life yet? Why don't you grow up? This is the 20th century." Actually, it is the adolescent who is naive, ignorant, and untaught in the truth about the facts of life. Going steady. The basic cause of today's immorality, of course, is human nature. Human nature is the basic cause of all violence, war, crime, all our troubles in this present evil world. But, as stated in the beginning of this chapter, human nature expresses itself in different ways and adapts itself to changing times. Human nature is, simply, the subconscious pull of a definite attitude of mind. It is the attitude that became Satan's. It is the natural attitude implanted from infancy by the invisible Satan. It is the attitude of vanity, of self-concern, of lust and greed. It is the attitude of hostility to others and resentment of authority over it. Of course, the self, as explained before, expands into the empirical self, which includes those with whom individual self is associated or connected. This may include one's family, his club, his gang, his church, his country. Patriotism is an example of the empirical self expanded to include one's country. But patriotism is expressed in the form of loyalty to country as opposed to other countries. It includes an automatic hostility toward other countries, either passive or active. The Bible, Moffat translation, classifies this as party spirit, Galatians 5:20, and one of the deeds of the flesh, as opposed to the fruit of the Spirit. The natural tendency to want to belong is merely the expression of this phase of human nature. This leads to the desire to want to go along with those one accepts as his peer group, team, gang, or whatever. This nature expresses itself in young people by the natural pull to want to go along with the teens as opposed to their elders. If the teens have a new custom frowned on by their elders, then self associates with the teens and feels automatic and natural from human nature hostility and resentment toward the opposing elders. But what about going steady? This started several years ago as an American custom. The custom spread. It is a new way started by those in the middle and late teens. But when 18 and 19-year-olds began going steady, 16 and 17-year-olds began to emulate, Galatians 5:20, and to go along. Then 14 and 15-year-olds responded to the pull to go along, and today even the 12 and 13-year-olds are beginning to go steady. This subject has been discussed before in this book. Going steady brings familiarity, and familiarity breeds a certain contempt. In this instance, contempt for chastity, virtue, and honor. This going steady is simply the natural response to the pull of human nature. Human nature is essentially lazy. When a boy or girl goes steady, he feels assured of dates. The boy is spared the embarrassment of asking new girls for dates and the possible humiliation of being turned down. The girl feels a sense of security knowing she will have dates. The very familiarity of steady dating makes it easier for the boy to make bolder advances in necking and then going on further into sexual intercourse. It makes it more difficult for the girl to say no. It tends to lower bars of resistance and increases the temptation to carry intimacies to the limit. The fruits of going steady are definitely not good. It is one of the most difficult things in the world to convince an adolescent of the wisdom of doing what he ought to do instead of what he wants to do. But yielding to what one wants to do is surrendering to human nature. It is traveling the road to sin. And sin is man's greatest enemy, inflicting on him every pain, heartache, suffering, and anguish he ever experiences. It inflicts unwanted penalties. But again, it is hard for people to understand why they can't put their hands on a red-hot stove and not get burned. If a parent has not taught his child basic rules of character from infancy, it is a little late by age 14, 15, or 16 to convince him he ought not to go steady. He is now too big and set in his ways to listen readily, and his mind is still too young and immature to recognize truth. But going steady is not good for those who do it. Now what about necking? Is necking wrong? To even ask the question, is necking wrong, would sound rather silly to the average adolescent today. Why? Because of ignorance, because of wrong teaching and a lack of right teaching, because there are some of the facts of life they have not yet learned. Is the Bible an out-of-date book? If it is, how does it happen that it so accurately foretells today's world news, so understandingly pinpoints human nature? It says, the carnal mind is hostile toward God, and that is certainly true. Where God says, remember, everyone immediately forgets. When Jesus said, think not I am come to destroy the law, everyone proceeded to think he did destroy it. If God in the Bible said, observe Christmas, New Year's, and Easter, then nobody would. God created humankind, male and female. God blessed humans with a wonderful God-plane marriage and family relationship. God designed sex to bring indescribable delights and joys with his blessing in marriage. In his great wisdom, God created men so that sex arousal and desire often takes place more rapidly than in their wives. And he designed women so that they are not physically or mentally prepared for actual coitus until arousal is brought about by the love embrace, by caressing, by the love talk and endearing words of the husband. In other words, by necking and petting. There was vital purpose in this. Had God made women to be aroused by the same means and the same quickness as their husbands, sexual intercourse in marriage would seldom, if ever, be that supreme expression of love that God intended in order to bind and hold together the marriage and the home and family. Marriage would be robbed of its blessings, of its supreme joys. But when boys and girls engage in premarital lovemaking, called necking, petting, and even heavy petting, these terms are defined in an earlier chapter, it is not the love that binds more firmly that which God has bound for life. It is mere sensual gratification. It is lust, no matter what you wish to call it. It cheapens, tarnishes, corrodes the entire wonderful experience God intended as a repeated lifelong experience in marriage. And it detracts from and robs the participants of the full happiness they might have had in a future marriage. This lovemaking, this necking or petting, this caressing is all a part of, and actually the most important part of, sexual intercourse in marriage. A capital sin. Therefore, when indulged in prior to marriage or outside of marriage, it is a capital sin. Teenage custom does not determine what is sin. College campus practices do not define right and wrong. Acceptance by society does not decide what is sin. God Almighty has already determined what is sin. God does not allow humans to decide what is sin, but he forces us to decide whether to sin. He has called me to lift up my voice and show people what is sin. That is what I am doing here. I did not devise that law or set it in dynamic, living, if invisible, motion. God did. How can you prevent the tragedy of a premarital pregnancy? How can you prevent the disgrace and terrible predicament of venereal disease? By knowing when to stop? No, by simply not starting the necking in the first place. If it were good for young people, God would have instructed them to engage in it. But sin is not good for people. Sin harms people. In an earlier chapter, we described how people are drawn into sin. It is explained in James 1, verses 14 and 15. Every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then, when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. The temptation is not a sin. Sin is when the mind harbors the temptation, retains it, keeps thinking of it, keeps desiring it, until the desire conceives into the action of sin. How does one avoid sin? By not retaining the desire, by pushing it out of mind immediately. But to start in the action of sin and think you can draw the line that you know when to stop is to commit sin. The time to prevent sin is before it starts. This world society and its customs are based on human nature, which is to say on Satan's ways, and are diametrically contrary to God's ways. Go along with the crowd and you are stumbling along with the other dumb sheep to the slaughter. Why be one of the crowd? Why not stand out from the crowd of ignoramuses and weaklings as one who has knowledge, wisdom, and character? Any old dead fish can float downstream, but it takes a live one to swim against the current. This is not prudish talk. It is not old-fashioned talk. It is intelligent, rational understanding based on the instruction of the Creator. What a shame that the adolescents of today were not taught properly by their parents from babyhood. It is the God-required duty of every parent, a responsibility for which parents will be held accountable in the judgment, to properly teach and inform their children of the facts of sex. This teaching ought to begin while children are still small. Dating a lost art? Has dating become a lost art? It would certainly seem so. Certainly there is no art to the manner of dating today. It seems young people no longer know what to do with themselves on dates. Perhaps most dates today are spent either in a car parked by the roadside in a dark and secluded spot, where the time is spent in necking or in sexual intercourse, or else in a darkened motion picture theater letting their minds drift with a ready-made daydream. Dating is no longer stimulating mentally, upbuilding socially, and intellectually beneficial. It tends not to build, but to destroy character. Some dating, of course, is spent at various kinds of dances. Some of these may be invigorating physically and at least somewhat mentally. Some are downgrading and morally and mentally harmful, depending on environment and character and quality of participants. In my dating days, I had a system. I was unconverted, and the motive undoubtedly, in part at least, was vanity. But I did try to date only top-level girls. Of course, we sometimes went to the theater, occasionally to the motion pictures, it was during the silent days, occasionally to a dance, but never to a public dance. Public dances then were not in good repute. But usually our date involved a walk, a scintillating and enlightening conversation, and possibly a soda or sundae at an ice cream parlor. I devoted considerable time in public libraries, in the philosophical or travel or biography departments, acquiring knowledge for interesting conversation. On a first date, I analyzed and sized up the girl. I didn't know how a fellow fell in love, but I supposed it might happen unexpectedly in some mysterious way. And I didn't want it to happen to me in the case of an unqualified girl. If my first date appraisal of the girl indicated definitely that, should I fall for her, she would be unsuitable as a wife and the mother of my children, there was never a second date. I was taking no chances on falling overboard with the wrong girl to the point I might be so blinded by love I would be unable to see it. I remember one girl, pretty, attractive, good conversationalist. She got a second date. But then I discovered she was lazy, would not help her mother with dishes, making beds, and housework. I never dated her again. I dated two or three girls, frequently but not regularly, or like going steady in any sense, who had absolutely no sex appeal for me whatsoever. There would have been no temptation to neck, as teenage call it today. Of one, I said I would as soon have my arms around a cold iron lamppost. Yet I dated her on occasion because she was an unusually fine girl whom I respected highly and an interesting conversationalist. Dating can and ought to be made a real art. Some thinking and planning ought to go into the preparation for a date. A date should be an event which adds to the mental, social, moral, and spiritual character development of both boy and girl. Such a date is so much more rewarding and leaves a far more palatable feeling afterward. In today's warped and perverted thinking, I suppose that suggestion seems very old-fashioned and naive. But for those who have a little sense and understanding, it would be wise to heed it. Dating should be made interesting. But a date can be both interesting and at the same time stimulating, uplifting, and a contribution to the very purpose of life, character building. If my system did nothing better, it protected me until the eternal God brought the finest little woman in the world and me together. Our dates were stimulating, challenging, dynamically interesting. They still were more than 49 years later. Instructing small children. Sex instruction should begin as early as little minds begin to show curiosity about little bodies, and that might be as early as age 2 or 3. The birds and the bees method has been ridiculed, but it is a sensible way nevertheless. To little children, explain first about God. Explain about creation. Explain how God created the plants, the flowers, the birds, the bees, and the animals. Then explain how God is a spirit being who looks like a man, who has a face, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, who has a body and hands and feet. Only God is composed of spirit, and his eyes are like flames of fire, and his face shines as brightly as the sun, so bright no human could look at him without having his eyes blinded by the great light. God has all power, and so he caused all these things to come into being. Then explain how God decided to make man in his very own likeness, not like animals or birds or plants, and to give us minds like his, only he made us out of matter, and so we do not know as much as he or have as much power. But just as all plants and animals were created to be male and female and to reproduce their own kind, so God made humans male and female so we could have little babies who become children and grow up to be just like daddy and mommy. Then explain how wonderful it is that even a little baby starts from a tiny seed or egg, which is kept as it grows, where the mother can best protect and watch over and nourish as it develops. You will be able to fill in the details. I won't attempt it here. And show how humans can be a loving family like God, and how a baby has a home and a mother and father to love it, and not have to be out all by itself like baby animals. Connect it all with God and with love and with family relationship. And above all, explain to your child that you will answer all his questions and instruct him to come to you with all questions, but never to talk about this very wonderful but private subject with other children. Of course, you cannot tell a 2 or 3 year old more than a small part of sex knowledge, but as the child grows older, explain more from time to time. Keep ahead of the gutter. Child discipline, a parental responsibility. One of the greatest sins, crimes, tragedies of this world society is that great sin of omission, the neglect of parents to teach their children. Not only about sex, most parents neglect to teach their children, period. But first, before you attempt to teach your children, especially about sex, educate yourself. To enable parents to do that is a major purpose of this book. After you have finished it, go back and read it all again. Always give your children an abundance of love. Show your affection. Then from tiniest infancy, by loving but unquestionable insistence, bring your child to absolute recognition of your authority and before he reaches the end of his first year. If spanking is necessary, use it, always being careful not to injure the child, yet making it smart enough to get results. Most mothers spank too lightly. That may do harm rather than good, especially psychologically. Some fathers spank, beat, or paddle too hard. Make it hurt enough to accomplish the purpose, but without injury. The main point in spanking is to apply the principle of the adage that the stitch in time saves nine. Do not spank your child into obeying you. One mother couldn't understand why her spanking never got results. She spanked only in final desperation to force the child to do what he was told. She told her 4-year-old boy it was time to go to bed. He didn't want to. She threatened to spank. That was her first mistake. She should immediately have spanked him for disobedience. Instead, she threatened. He was accustomed to the threats and knew by experience she probably would neglect to carry it out. 10 minutes later, she threatened again, a little impatient, a little angry. Then another 10 minutes, and it was repeated. Finally, half an hour after her first command, she forcibly spanked him into bed and wondered why this spanking had to be repeated so often. Never spank in anger. Always be sure your child understands your command or instruction. If this is made sure, then spank, crisply enough that the child doesn't want it repeated, for disobedience to authority. The parent who hesitates is lost. Do it immediately. First, be sure the child understood. Second, be sure you teach, get in the lesson, make plain and in love why you are spanking. Third, spank without delay. Don't say, "This is going to hurt me more than it will you." Make it hurt him enough, without injury, that he won't want to disobey again. But make him understand he made you do it, not because you wanted to, but because he made you. Don't be afraid of what the crackpot child psychologists fear, to make him feel guilty. When a child disobeys, he is guilty and must be made to realize it. When we disobey God, he tells us plainly in the Bible that we are guilty. Yet God loved us enough to give Christ to die for us, that the sin may be forgiven upon repentance. So let the child know he is guilty, but he can be forgiven upon repentance, which means to change from the spirit of rebellion to an attitude of willing obedience. But don't humiliate your child, especially before others. The most cruel thing one person can do to another is to make him feel whipped or to cause him to lose all confidence or induce an inferiority complex. True humility is required for right godly character, but one can be humble and still properly confident. True confidence is not self-confidence, but faith in God. Space does not allow more along this line in this work. Instructing about puberty. Never lie to your child. Never refuse to answer questions about sex. Never say you're not old enough to know that yet. Always find a way to give a right explanation in a right manner and within the understanding and capacity of your child. Never reproach your child for asking questions about sex by accusing him of interest in indecent things. Be sure you represent sex as God ordained its right uses as decent, good, and actually something sacred and pure, and to be kept that way. Make your child understand early enough that good things may be put to sinful uses. When the little child asks his mother, "Where did I come from?" tell him the truth. Let the mother say, "You grew into a baby inside of me here under my heart," and she can point. In teaching little children to keep pubic regions covered, never talk about it being indecent in a way to give the impression sex is indecent. But explain it is not proper to be exposed to others. Sex is something God wants kept private. If a little boy and his little sister ask about sex differences, it's certainly time to begin instruction about sex and why God made it so. Answer. Don't tell your child the stork lie. One little fellow said to another little boy, "I found out that all that stuff about the stork bringing my little sister and about Santa Claus isn't true, and so now I'm going to look into this Jesus Christ story, too." Doctors report cases of 12- and 13-year-old girls being brought to them by distraught parents on the occasion of their first menstruation. The parents didn't know how to explain, and it was too embarrassing. This should never be. If children have been properly instructed about sex gradually as they grow up, all girls should have been fully instructed about menstruation before they reach the age of puberty. Any mother can and should completely explain what is found in the early and last portions of chapter 9 in this book in a manner to cause her daughter to consider with reverence and awe how wonderfully God has designed her body and his functions, especially of the marvelous laboratories, the ovaries. If the mother is dead, the father should have no difficulty in explaining this with the help of chapter 9 and other portions of this book. Every boy should be completely instructed before he reaches the age of puberty, and the proper explanation is found in chapter 9, especially the middle portion. A boy reaches puberty when he discharges semen in his sleep. Every boy should be fully and properly instructed about this before he reaches this stage of physical maturity. He should be made to understand that night emissions, termed nocturnal emissions, are natural and normal, the natural safety valve which God designed to eliminate the excess semen as it develops, so that neither masturbation nor premarital sex experience is necessary, and neither should ever be resorted to. Truth about masturbation. Nearly all books about sex produced by the medical doctors, psychiatrists, and others from the purely physical approach assert that masturbation is not harmful. They are wrong. Why must humans, even the professionals, always go to one or the other extreme as far from truth as possible? On the one hand, many boys have been told falsely that masturbation causes insanity, loss of virility, sterility, pimples, etc., etc. This is not true. Scaring boys with lies is not the thing to do. On the other hand, masturbation is a form of perversion. It is a sin. It does harm the boy or the man physically over a period of 12 to 24 hours by dulling the mind, even causing a partial blurring of sight and acting as a partial anesthetic to the memory. Often a boy will experience absent-minded proclivities following masturbation. It is harmful psychologically. The mind is on self, on sex, not on a lovely wife. Invariably, it produces a guilty conscience and destroys normal confidence. Sex experience belongs in marriage. The mental attitude is the all-important factor. God intended it to be that sacred and wonderful relationship of expressing love and that most intimate and personal of all human physical and psychological experiences, which binds husband and wife together truly as one flesh. When sex is expressed in any other way, it robs one of a portion of that blissful, delightful, and truly wonderful God-ordained experience. Remember, love is giving, an outgoing concern as well as sharing. Masturbation is neither. Masturbation is either plain lust or else a desire for relief. But God provided for relief through the means of nocturnal emissions during sleep. If such natural relief is needed, the boy or man may induce it by sleeping on his back. Most boys and many girls get into the habit of masturbation at an age so young they simply cannot remember its beginning after growing up. It is a nasty habit, often almost impossible to break. There is no greater plague. Even a baby may discover a pleasurable sex sensation. It could and often does happen accidentally. Even before 1 year old, some babies may discover this and start masturbating. The parent should be constantly on guard. Treat it in infancy in the same category as thumb sucking or putting a finger in his nose. Teach the child that he should not play with parts of the body. Do not frighten him. Do not lie to him. Just tell him his thumb or his penis or his nose was given him for a different purpose and he must not misuse it. And back up your teaching with discipline and punishment if necessary. And don't assume that only boys and men masturbate. It is a perversion practiced by girls and grown women also. The difference in sex is only relative. A higher percentage of males practice it, but more females are guilty of it than commonly realized. This will require constant vigilance. Don't neglect it. It is a serious parental responsibility. Circumcision. The matter of circumcision was treated in an earlier chapter. At a cost of repetition, it should be mentioned in this connection. As a religious rite, as the Apostle Paul explained, circumcision under the New Testament is spiritual, of the heart, and not of the flesh. Although it is not today a religious rite, nevertheless, it is urgently recommended for all male babies, for purely physical reasons. Circumcision will greatly lessen the danger of masturbation. Chapter 13, The Best Age for Marriage. Ignorance about sex is not, of course, the only cause of unhappy marriage and divorce. Many causes contribute. Religious difference is one. The Roman Catholic Church is very emphatic in restraining its members from marrying non-Catholics. Neither should a truly converted Christian ever marry a non-Christian. God commands Christians, "Be you not unequally yoked together with unbelievers, for what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion has light with darkness?" 2 Corinthians 6:14. That fellowship of a Christian with unbelievers should be avoided, even in dating, for dating too often leads to marriage. What about dating? In different ways, according to varying customs, dating has been practiced as far back as history records. But in all things, dating has a right and a wrong use. The right kind of dating has become virtually a lost art today, especially in America. Enough has been said in chapters 11 and 12 in regard to the almost universal modern custom of necking, petting, heavy petting, and premarital intercourse. These immoral practices dominate modern-day dating. Most dates consist of either this sort of thing or a ready-made daydream watching a motion picture. Enough also has been said about going steady. This should not be done by teenagers. After one is mentally, emotionally, and spiritually mature and qualified to assume the responsibilities of marriage, steady dating with the most likely choice for an engagement to be married becomes a different matter. But until then, avoid going steady. Date different ones. Let the dates be on a higher mental, intellectual, and ethical plane. Let the dates be upbuilding, contributing to mutual self-improvement. When I was a young man, a date was a challenge. My effort was to make the date mentally stimulating and enjoyably beneficial. Of course, some of them included dances, the theater, an occasional movie. But often they included ice skating or other such interests, and often simply going walking with a scintillating conversation. In Ambassador College, we encouraged dating, but we very definitely discouraged going steady until the middle of the senior year. And remember this, It is God who joins together in marriage a husband and a wife. Therefore, it ought to be in your own interest, God who selects for you the husband or wife you're going to marry. And God will do this if you ask Him and then refrain from getting in a hurry and taking it into your own hands. This may require self-restraint and patience, yes, and also faith. But if you rely on God, He will not fail you. And if He selects your lifelong mate, you'll have the right one. I didn't realize this before I was married, yet I have always known that, in His mercy, God did select for me the young woman I married. And now, more than a half century later, I am more sure of it than ever before. If you're a parent of one or more teenage children, should you try to force your children to date only converted young people, or those of your choice? You'll drive them directly the other way if you do. Your responsibility is to teach your children the truth, and teach them as they grow up gradually to assume more and more responsibility themselves. Of course, this teaching ought to begin during their first year of infancy. For many of our readers, it will be too late for that now. Then, use tact. Your children may now be past the age where you can guide their lives. They have minds of their own. But in sympathetic understanding and tact, try to induce them to be willing to counsel with you in regard to general principles and truths. But never try to pick for them the one they are to marry. If you have a choice, above all, never let them know it, unless they voluntarily ask your counsel and advice. Otherwise, you'll drive them the opposite direction. But in my nearly 50 years of counseling in the problems of unhappy marriages and divorces, the overwhelming majority of cases involve couples who married too young. Thousands have asked us, what is the best age for marriage? An article on this subject has appeared twice in The Plain Truth. The answer to that question is so vitally important it simply cannot be omitted from this book. Therefore, it is here reprinted to complete the remainder of this chapter. Too young to marry. Some 20 years ago, I officiated at a wedding in Stately Memorial Hall at Ambassador College in England, now closed. My next to youngest grandson, Richard David Armstrong II, then aged 2½, thought the ceremony so very nice, he said, "Mommy, I want to get married." "Well," answered his mother, a little shocked, a little amused, "and whom do you want to marry?" "Karen," replied little Dickie promptly. "But Karen has just been married. She can't marry anybody else now." "Well, then," decided Dickie, "I'll marry Sheila." Sheila is a very nice Irish colleen and was then a student in the college. "But Sheila is grown up now and in college," protested Mommy. "What if she won't have you?" "Then I'll marry you, Mommy," came the quick decision. Marriage is not for children. We may smile at the idea of a 2- or 3-year-old getting married. It would be a bit irregular. Marriage is not for children. Marriage is for adults. Marriage is pretty serious business. Marriage entails the assuming of very serious responsibilities. Children do not realize this, of course. Marriage is a lot more than romance. It is more than daydreams about a prince charming or floating around on cloud 9 or being in a lover's arms. But when do we become adults? Are not boys and girls adults at around age 14? No, far from it. Let's understand why. Age for acquiring knowledge. Human beings know nothing at birth. We have to learn or be taught everything. Without any knowledge or with erroneous knowledge, we are helpless as newborn babes. But there are some things many fail to learn. One of these is the right age for marriage. Whatever an adult knows, true or false, has come into his mind since birth. It may sound surprising or incredible, but a person actually learns more during his first year of life than in any succeeding year. If a 1-year-old baby could talk plainly with complete and adequate vocabulary, you'd be completely amazed at how much he has learned that first year.
This completes tape number 5, side number 1 of The Missing Dimension in Sex. Please continue on side 2.